Bond. Good afternoon, everyone. Afternoon, everyone. Afternoon. All right, let's get this show on the road. Level 200 session, just so you know that. So, afternoon. My name is Greg Taylor. I'm with the Exchange Customer Experience team. And this is ARC 202, Publishing Exchange. Which three-letter acronym, TLA, should you choose? All right, so here's kind of a rough idea of what I'm going to talk about for the next hour or so. A little bit of history, because it's always good to cover a little bit of history, find out where we are, where we came from. And then we'll talk about risks today and choices today, and then, you know, we'll hopefully end up with some kind of advice, guidance you can take away and figure out what it all means to you. So let's start with a bit of casting your mind back. So in the beginning of software development, there were a bunch of hippies who wrote software. They were really clever and stuff, and they just wrote this software, and they thought everyone should have a go at this software, right? You know, accessing what we've written because it's really cool. Then a bad guy came along because he realized there was an opportunity to get hold of somebody's data. It was kind of fun at the same time as well, and there was real value in it potentially. And then came the IT security guy. The pointy-headed little fella, right, who makes all the rules and tries to stop all of us having a bit of fun and getting access to data and all of those good things. And the IT security guy decreed that we shall build walls around all of your software, you little hippie. And so he did. He built walls. Everywhere he could think of putting a wall, he'd put up a wall, he'd put up a rule, he'd put up a wall. But there was one slight problem with that. And what was that? Well, and he put all the NT4 servers in a big closet, and he pulled out the network cable as well, because he figured if nobody can access the data, then it's probably more secure. It's going to be like this the whole way through, promise you. Told you, level 200, kids, it's finger puppet time. Right, okay. So there was a bit of a problem here, and you can see the little guy who's written the software, he's like, let me out, they want to access the data. And so the security guy had a plan. He made a hole. That's IT security, or it was. All right, so what's wrong with that picture? So, or what's wrong with that whole story? How did we do that? So filtering at that IP layer really isn't giving you any idea about what's going on inside the packet, right? You're just doing pure network layer filtering, ports, protocols, that's just about it. And of course, one of the downsides of that, it meant that anonymous connections could get through. As long as you knew which endpoint to reach, you could get through to it. So that was a bit of a problem. So our IT security guy, he had a plan. He got smart. That was the first thing that he did. He went to school and he figured out, what can we do about this? So he decided to build more walls, because he's good at walls, the IT security guy. He built walls and he put them either side of him. He created a DMZ, perimeter network, right? And then what he decided to do was to be a bit clever about it, and he'd create himself an allow list and a block list, like a guest list at a party. Your name's not on the door, you can't come in, that kind of stuff, right? Now, what was wrong with that? Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons that, you know, that's been problematic for a number of reasons. So the HTTP filter, for example, the HTTP filter for years has been able to do filtering of specific verbs, and you can do a whole bunch of additional clever stuff within HTTP filters, removing verbs, all of that kind of stuff. But nobody ever did that, did they? Or very few of you ever did that. And it also made troubleshooting really hard when you did. And the Exchange team never gave you any guidance on how to do that. And I'm thinking about Exchange in, you know, let's think about Exchange for most of today. We are at Mac after all. So nobody ever configured it to do those things. We didn't tell you how to do it. And so essentially, the default stayed at the year 2000 when this whole idea was really being born. Now, here's an interesting fact that the TMG and the ISO, the feature pack 1 for ISO 2000, they essentially have the same understanding of an Exchange packet. You remember all that, we understand what really goes on inside an Exchange packet? Well, we did at the year 2000, or they did, not really beyond that, so there was the problem. And so what does all this really do? Well, complexity breeds support cases like bunnies. Told you, it won't end. It will just keep going. In fact, I could stand here for a minute and it will just keep going. Complexity support cases. All right, so why did it happen? Well, it happened because the software industry was changing so fast, right? Software industry changing fast, we're bringing new features and functionality. And the security considerations were secondary. You know, everyone thought about securing it after they'd already, you know, developed features. That was very much the mindset of software development. Hacking was cool. You know, who wants to play global thermonuclear war? I did. After watching that movie, it looked awesome. All right, so that was another thing that came on. So then we got into the world of the proliferation of the perimeter network. How many of you have ever worked with a customer who's got more than two perimeter net, or two or more? There we go, right. Because more is better, right? Right, of course it is. Okay, and the security guy, therefore, proliferated as well, because you need more security guys to help manage all the multiple layers of perimeter network that you've established. And we, Exchange, told you at the time that ISA and Exchange were better together. And the thing was, at the time, it's actually kind of true. At the time, it was a really good idea. At the time, really, if you did anything else, you were opening yourself up to a whole heap of pain. And why was that? Well, because you were defending against these products, the acoustic coupler. All right, maybe it's a bit of a stretch, that one, right? But Windows 2000, Exchange 2000, awesome products, right? Agreed, awesome, bulletproof, absolutely nothing wrong with any of them. So back to the current day, when you look at this, you know, are you still using the same software? Are you still protecting it the same way as you used to? Are the threats the same? Are the attackers the same? Well, no, they're not, are they? So why are we treating security the same way that we've always treated it? Why are we putting up firewalls and establishing rules and doing pre-auth and all of this kind of stuff? Because we did it 10, 13 years ago. What's changed? Well, quite a lot has changed. So the threats that we're facing today are really quite different. Now, there's a really fascinating paper, which I've linked to at the bottom here, the Basic Laws of Hackonomics, which would be worth a read. And there's a bunch of little rules here, so let's go through this. So what it says is, and it is an interesting read, you should go see it, most attackers aren't evil or insane. They just want something. Well, we don't really, right, we're not really able to protect against truly, you know, evil people, because there are other ways of doing it, but we can protect against people that look for weaker targets. I mean, the amount of money you can spend securing yourself is essentially infinite, right? Which then leads to the second point, which is that security is not really about security. It's about mitigating risk at some cost, understanding what the risk is, and then understanding what you're going to spend to defend against that risk or some portion of that risk. You might not be able to defend against all of it. But let's keep it real. You know, there are too many fantasy scenarios that we're trying to protect against. There's certainly some of that. So we tend to focus on risks that are familiar or recent. We tend to focus still on those risks from years ago that we used to face. And the question, the hard question to ask, and I'm going to keep preaching the same point, because we all have those difficult conversations with our security teams and folks, and I had one earlier today with somebody as well, who think that adding layers and adding complexity and scanning everything that goes on is increasing security. Arguably, it probably is, but at what cost? You know, what are you protecting against? Could you do it more simply? And complexity, as we know, breeds bunny rabbits. A fact that most costly breaches come from simple failures, not from attacker ingenuity. And I'm sure we'd probably all agree, that seems pretty fair, right? Simple mistakes are generally what lead to problems, not the movie Hollywood style hacking that goes on. I mean, who doesn't laugh when you see, like, you know, somebody trying to hack into computers in the movies, right? The layers of firewalls being attacked by red things. I mean, it's awesome. It's complete bloody nonsense, right? And we know it is. But the bad guys, if properly incentivized, can be very creative. We know they can. But I've always found as well that the more interesting discussions I get into and the more zealous security people that I've come across work for companies whose data isn't what you and I would probably think as typically, you know, mission critical, right? There are different worlds and industries and things that people are protecting. But, you know, if you're a pencil-making company, you know, is that how you make your pencils, the really slightly different kind of scope of risk. Anyway, in the absence of security education or experience, people would naturally make poor security decisions with technology. So people making decisions are just following the guides, they're following the teaching. They're not really understanding, or they're not really, you know, trying to get to really the bottom of what those risks are. But of course, it also means that systems need to be easy to use securely and difficult to use insecurely. So when software is developed, it should be developed from a standpoint of it should be secure and easy to use. If the security makes it harder for users to use it, what do? They bypass it. Got a good story about that one later as well. It's kind of interesting. And here's a good one. The attackers look for the weakest point, generally, and that will be the people these days. Right? They're more likely to do social engineering and try and get access to data than they are to do a movie-style, Hollywood-style attack on your firewall and try and get through. That's typically the most common route because it's a lot easier to hack people than it is some of the technology these days. So what do we do to the software, looking at the threats that we have today and what we did about them? So Microsoft did a bunch of stuff to try and increase the overall security of the software. So we did something called trustworthy computing, which I think probably everyone has probably heard of at some point, and that was some time ago, 2000 or so. So there was something we call the perfect storm. So there was a storm brewing. And this is actually a website you can go look at. It explains everything we did about trustworthy computing. Then we did something called a ramp up, because that sounds impressive. That's the reason why we choose these names. Then the next one was good. We went to a new bar, apparently. Not quite sure where that bar was, probably somewhere in Redmond. But we set a new bar. And then once we were done with that, finally we reached this thing called collaboration, right? So this is, you know, 10 years of changing the way we develop software. And as somebody who's actually been a PM for components within Exchange, I can tell you that even when you design a component in Exchange that isn't what you might typically think as a security risk or target, we go through a security audit. So I had, for the work I was doing, I had a bunch of security people within the Exchange team looking at the code and the attack vectors and how we had mitigated any possibility of risk. Even for a simple feature, we're doing full security risk analysis with everything that we do. So what does all that mean? You know, what has it really done? Well, it meant that ultimately Exchange and IIS in particular, because Windows have been doing this too. This wasn't just Exchange, right? In isolation, obviously. IIS got smarter and stronger. And as I think we all know, Exchange and IIS are pretty closely linked. Right? So the benefits that the Windows team brought to the security of IIS accrue to us in Exchange. So that's good. It meant that the host security got stronger as well. The platform, Windows, got stronger itself. We're securing at multiple layers. The data layer itself got stronger with encryption protocols and authentication. So the data layer got stronger too. And the perimeter got stronger because we reduced the attack surface area and we did a whole bunch of, you know, those kind of functions and features, right? Things like Windows Firewall and all those kind of rules. And so when you think about security, and this is something we've all heard before, which is it's defense in depth, right? It's not just one thing. You do several things. I've used before an onion as an example, because an onion can make you cry, just like the security guy can as well, right? So an onion. But I thought for this, we'd not have an onion. I thought instead we'd have a bank, right? Because let's say you're protecting the bank. Would you just close the door and lock it? No, you wouldn't. You'd put a perimeter around it. Well, but you've got to protect the perimeter. So what you do is you put sharks in the perimeter, deadly sharks, okay? And you might think, well, that's perfectly secure enough, but probably not. So you'd probably put yourself another perimeter as well. This is the defense in depth thing. And you'd probably put, I don't know, a couple of lions, let's say, just in case anyone got really near the bank. The lions will eat them, or the sharks will get them, or maybe a big spider. I found all kinds of interesting clip art while I was putting this presentation together. And then while searching the office clip art gallery, I put in the word dangerous. And do you know what I found? A guy talking on his cell phone while driving. Now, the reason why I suspect this is dangerous is, have you seen the size of that guy's phone? He's never going to be able to drive and talk on that phone at the same time. That's ridiculous. Anyway, all right. Defense in depth, multiple layers. There's the secret. I'm not suggesting multiple, you know, and this doesn't mean multiple perimeter networks, the DMZs and all of this. This is just thinking about host security, data security, network security, and all of those things. These can all still be on the same box. So what happened to the bad guys? Because the bad guys changed too. And we already covered this point, but the bad guys really realize that the people are the weak part in this whole link. That things like social networks are both a blessing, if you like that kind of stuff, but they're a bit of a curse too, because the bringing together of social networks meant that social engineering becomes so much easier as well. The fact that you know people can potentially link Facebook accounts to corporate, you know, they can use multiple different authentication providers to perhaps provide access to other systems, means that if you can get into their social status, you can hack into the social status, you potentially open up a whole bunch of access to corporate data. Would anyone disagree? It's a possibility, right? And how many people have the same password across multiple systems? I know I do. I'm preaching it. I'm not doing it, right? I'm just saying. But I know I use, you know, and so you think about it. Somebody uses the same password for a whole bunch of different systems, and social networking tells you where they work and a whole bunch of other stuff as well and what they were doing on Friday night. It's a very, you're kind of opening up this this kind of potentially dangerous scenario for which protection, you know, is kind of important to try and to work against this social networking aspect. And there's the thing, the bad guy's looking for the easy way in, and pretty much these days that is you and me. We are the weak links in all of this. So let me give you a story. This was at last Tech Ed. Had a very interesting conversation with a guy who was the exchange security IT guy for a large computer consulting company full of computer consultants like many of you. And the story that he told me was he was sad. He was sad. He was having a hard time in his job. And he was having a hard time in his job because what he really wanted to do was go and play golf. Or go skateboarding. Although probably I thought he was a little bit over the hill for skateboarding myself when I met him. But, you know, he told me he wanted to do that. Or maybe have his hair cut. I don't know. And then he was quite into DIY as well. And I dig that. I have a house I'm trying to fix up. But what he told me was he felt at work like a puppet. And he felt like a puppet because he had this tug of war going on with all the people that he worked with. Everything he was doing to protect his data, the bunch of computer consultants that he was looking after the data for would work around it because they were quite smart. Why were they working around it? To do their jobs. They weren't working around it because they thought it would be a real laugh behind this guy's back to get one over on him. They were just trying to do their jobs. But he was adding so many layers of security and complexity, and I'm going to add multi-factor auth tokens, and the code's going to change every 60 seconds, that these people were just trying to get their jobs done. He thought they were ganging up on him and run off with his data and then party on behind his back. But that's actually not really what was going on. So we had a bit of a chat, he and I. I'm the tall, handsome one on the right, obviously, although I haven't worn a suit for a long, long time. And so he did some cleaning up. He went and cleared up. This is true. He went and simplified his security. He simplified things. He took out a whole bunch of unnecessary controls that were kind of, you know, just duplicating each other. You know, taking out that do more, must be more secure attitude. He put an acceptable use policy in place and said, I'll fire you if you try and work around these. Okay? An acceptable use policy is essential, and it has to have teeth. You have to be able to actually act on it and follow it through. It's a bit like threatening a, you know, child to take away something, right? You just threaten them and don't do it, they just learn pretty darn fast you're not going to do anything about it. And then he put his feet up and sat back and watched. And what actually happened was everyone just kind of got on with working. They spent less time trying to go around him and more time just doing what they were actually there to do. They had secure access to the data. rather than had to go around security to get access to the data, which is a significant difference. And this brought him peace, which then led to love, right? And then he went back to the DIY, because that's typically what happens after those two come together. At least it did for me, anyway. All right. So some more evidential proof, if you need it. So Microsoft took away pre-auth in front of our Exchange environment years ago. I know what we've been telling you, but I'm telling you now. And in fact, here's another one, interesting one. So OAuth never had pre-auth. We have never done pre-auth in front of OAuth. How many of you are surprised by that fact? I would think quite a few. And actually, the reason why we didn't do it is kind of interesting. The reason why we originally never did it was because ISA server wouldn't allow a forms-based auth listener and a basic listener, essentially wouldn't allow forms with a fallback to basic, which is what you need for the same namespace for both OAuth FBA and ActiveSync and Outlook Anywhere. It was only later, I think it was ISA 2004, I think, that brought that capability along. Well, we'd already built it by that stage. We were running, hot and running. And so the FBA form was always being done on Exchange. We never had pre-auth. Surprising, perhaps. Exchange Online doesn't do pre-authentication in front of Exchange. There is not a big bank of TMG servers or UAG servers in front of Exchange Online. Can you imagine how many that would be? Quite a lot, so we haven't done that. And the subject of online reminds me of a conversation I had with somebody last week. We were talking about a customer who wanted to go hybrid. And so a customer that had pre-auth today and were interested in moving to Exchange Online with hybrid with on-prem, the security guys were, you know, what about IP spoofing? And they came up with all these really highly technical phrases that mean a lot to them and they hope don't mean anything to anyone else. But my point was, well, how does that change? How does, you know, because we know that for hybrid, hopefully you know that with TMG, if you're doing pre-auth, you have to exclude a few paths for federation to work. And they said, well, what about IP spoofing? I said, well, how does doing that change the risk of IP spoofing? Well, it doesn't. So why are we talking about IP spoofing as a new risk that was established because we want to do hybrid? Well, but, and then we go back to another whole con, you know, off we go again, talking about something else I don't actually understand very much. So how could we do all of those things? Why would we do all of those things? And the key really here, obviously, is around management and monitoring. So you've got to stop thinking like it's 1999. Prince. So pre-auth. I'm not saying pre-auth is entirely useless. We're going to talk some more about this. But it might help with things like a denial of service attack, you know, the traffic doesn't get all the way to the servers. But there's a ton of stuff it really doesn't buy you in this current day and age. So a properly managed and monitored Exchange environment does not require pre-auth. That is a fact. I stood at MEC whenever the last one was, and I made that comment. And I know somebody, you know, it was blogged in a few places that said, this isn't official guidance. You know, this is just an opinion. No, I'm telling you, it's official guidance. We don't think you need to do pre-auth in front of Exchange. You can, but we don't think you need to. But the keywords, of course, in order to be able to accomplish that is monitored and managed. What do those things mean? Well, putting a firewall in front of all of Exchange, I mean, does it let you sleep at night? Do you know, once the firewall goes in and you configure TMG, for example, do you then say, that's it, I'm done? I know probably some people think that they may actually do that. So just because you put in something like a pre-authenticating firewall doesn't actually mean your job is done, because you're actually watching the firewall instead of watching Exchange. So if you're going to spend your time watching the firewall, why don't you just watch Exchange instead? Okay, let's think about it for a second. I know you're not going to agree with all of these points, but I'm making them to be a little, I'm pushing a little bit, right? That's the idea. So, you know, putting in a security device is more of a security blanket. It's not a guarantee that you've covered yourself. It's just another layer in your security perimeter. And you know, it's not on its own, unprotected or unmonitored and watched, going to protect you really from a whole lot of stuff. Or it could, but it's not going to protect you from everything. Which brings me on to another thing as well, which is another reason why people do this, which is account lockout policies. How many of you still have account lockout policies? And if you haven't, I bet you it's more than that. So we haven't recommended using account lockout policies since forever. Why? Because they're an invitation to denial of service, right? An account password lockout, denial of service. So in the day and age that we live in, where your UPN is typically equal to your SMTP address, because users can't remember their UPN or their domain slash account login, but they can remember their SMTP address. And certainly for, you know, online services, having a UPN equal to your SMTP address is the answer, right? So if you know somebody's SMTP address, you know how to log in as them. And if you feel like it, for a laugh, you could log into the, hit their ORFBA page, try and log in a few times, and lock their account out. Try doing it to your spouse if they have email at work. You know, lock out their account just for a laugh. I'm not suggesting you really do. That was kind of slightly facetious. Because you all went, ooh, yeah, I might do that. But you think about it, you really can. So account lockout policies are what is causing that. Wouldn't a better strategy, rather than locking somebody's account out after three failed attempts, be to make sure they have a strong password or passphrase and then monitor to see attempts at hacking their password and then taking action on those, rather than people having their accounts locked out either by stupid mistake or malicious denial of service and then bothering the help desk to have their accounts reset? It's probably a familiar scenario for some of us, I would expect, okay? So here's the mitigation checklist. You know, here are the other things that you need to think about. So running the latest operating system with all the latest patches. These are really mind-numbingly obvious things, but these are things which I'm sure many of us would like to do and probably don't do. Maybe a different team manages the server side. What about Exchange, the latest updates? So the latest updates, when we bring them out, how long does it take for you to install them? I know from some of the people in this room, it takes them forever, right? And this, you know, not just features up, this security updates, we release all of these things, but obviously the responsibility is on the customer or the person operating the system to install them, because they're no use to you whatsoever on the Microsoft Download Center. You know, protecting you against things, obviously, that's not really the place. So do you know what's going on at the network edge? Is there monitoring at the network edge? Do people really understand what traffic is coming in, what traffic's being denied, where it's coming from? Where it's coming from is really important as well. Okay, and there are plenty of ways that the security guys add a lot of value in this case, because they actually can understand this at the network edge. They can do you good here. Protect stuff at the network layer and stop it getting to Exchange is not a bad approach. And then the last one's an interesting one, which is, you know, what about the threats inside the organization? What are the security team to mitigate the threats inside? So when they're telling you that you can't publish Exchange to the internet without two-factor auth, who's ever heard that one? We need two-factor auth. So what does that mean? It means a secure ID token. No, it doesn't, actually. A secure ID token is an implementation of two-factor auth. It is not two-factor auth, like in a box, two-factor auth. There's different ways of doing two-factor auth. Something you have and something you know. It could be certificates and passwords. It's another approach of doing it. There's a whole different bunch of ways of doing it. But we get to that point, and then you say, well, what have you done inside the network to stop people from stealing data? And, you know, it opens up a whole can of worms, which is kind of fun, because then the look on their faces is like, oh, well, nothing, really. You say, oh, well, then stop picking on me. Pick on them. And then move along quickly. All right. All right, so we're all good then, yeah? Everyone happy? Don't need pre-auth, just keep everything monitored and managed. And any questions? All right, I better go on a bit more then. Okay, right, so. Did I fool anyone? Yeah, there you go. All right, so you're not buying it. Well, why not? Some of you should be. You really should. And I'm going to keep convincing you as to why you should buy it. So here's some good reasons. Here's some good objections that come up. So it's policy to put it in the DMZ. I'm going to put the Exchange CAS role in the perimeter network, says the security guy, because it's safer. No, it's not. All right? And it's, well, the SSL has to terminate in the DMZ. Why is that? Because it's the policy. When did you write the policy? 1987. And it rocks. That's why we still have the same policy. I'm so going to get mugged by security people at some point. I really am. I know I am. Anyway, but, you know, I'm sure we've all heard that one, right? Then it's, the objection is, well, our data is really important, super secret, we don't trust anyone. Heard that one quite a lot. Another could be that the convoluted network topology that the security guys insisted you do with your multiple levels of network means that you can't actually route traffic. You can't actually route traffic from the outside to the inside because of all the different layers of stuff that it goes through, which do what? Bugger all, except add levels of complexity and make it impossible to really do anything useful. That's true in some cases. I'm not arguing every case here, right? But I'm saying that in a lot of these cases, the extra layers do nothing than add network complexity. I also had a customer once who said, well, we have to terminate it in the DMZ, so the ActiveSync traffic, this one particularly was, we have to terminate it there so our content inspection sniffing super secret software can log all the traffic. I said, so you capture every piece of traffic, you decrypt, and that's what you do, yeah? He said, yeah. That includes people's credentials. Is that right? Encrypted with Base64, which is all BASIC is done, actually, which is trivial to reverse and, you know, yeah, that's what we do. So I turned to the business guy and I said, did you know that they capture all your usernames and passwords and log them into their database? And he said, do you? Yes. And I was like, off you go. And this is what you would call a security customer, right? They do have something to protect, right? Okay, pre-auth must be better than nothing. Absolutely. Absolute rubbish, right? You bought the software, and you are going to use it. Because we've got this thing, so we're going to use that software. That's a reason I've heard. I've also heard, we've already bought the storage. Can you now design Exchange? Anyone ever heard that one? Same old story, right? We bought the storage. We've got a cracking deal on the storage. Can you now design Exchange to fit it? Not quite the way we tend to like to do things. There's the, we want to interrogate the device. Have a good old poke around. That's another approach for doing this. For what? I'm not exactly sure. And in an age of bring your own device, not sure what, you know, you can do that reliably on an ongoing basis. The multi-factor auth, we require multi-factor auth. And like I said already, though, multi-factor auth is not a simple solution. It's not a, you know, there's lots of different ways of solving the same kind of problem. So I often get into discussions about what you're after is multi-factor auth, not a particular solution. And then you can look at alternative ways of achieving the same goal. And of course, the last one might be you're just simply terrified of the security guy. Because he knows, apparently, seems to know a lot more about this than you do. Which is kind of cool. And they like, and so he should, honestly. But you know way more about Exchange than he does. So we're all kind of even in that game. All right, so what are the choices? Here comes some TLAs. You've got TMG and UAG and ARR. Sorry, I couldn't help it. I didn't have to do that. You've got WAP as well. You've got load balancers that can do pre-auth, and you've got other reverse proxy devices too. And I know I said earlier that I'm thinking about Exchange, but I realize that the choice of what you use could potentially impact other applications that you're publishing too. And so the choice that you might make may be a strategic rather than a tactical choice. It depends on the makeup of the organization. In some organizations, they own the TMG, the Exchange guys own the TMG server or whatever it is that's publishing it. In others, it's owned by some other group. And they may be trying to make strategic choices for all the applications that are being published, not just Exchange. Okay? So I'll absolutely concede that point, but I just want to, you know, think that obviously we're Exchange people, so to hell with the rest of them, okay? Just for the time being, anyway. So let's go customize back to TMG. TMG rocked for Exchange deployments. Anyone disagree? No. Right? Great product. TMG covered all the Exchange scenarios we cared about. It could do forms-based auth. It could pretend to be Exchange. It even had the, you know, the OAuth forms-based auth page that would pop up, and people wouldn't really know unless they happened to look at the bottom and it was secured by Threat Management Gateway and it wasn't an Exchange FBA form. It could do basic auth and NTLM. We could do certificate-based auth. We could do IPsec against it as well. You know, a whole bunch of clever stuff we could do. And TMG obviously could authenticate the user against something like Active Directory or, well, against AD, obviously, but either directly against AD or with LDAP or RADIUS. And it could also do authorization for allowing you access to publishing rules as well. It was kind of cool, kind of useful, very powerful tool for publishing Exchange. But it really didn't know much about more than Exchange, really, than, you know, in that HTTP filter than it did way back at the beginning when it was still ISA. That was the point already made. So that you were certainly doing layer 7 interception, and you're passing it through some filters that make sure, but very few people actually ever customized it. There were ways you could customize it and tighten it down, but very few people did. And so it really was great for pre-auth, an application inspection to a very limited degree. But TMG, as we know, rest in peace. Oh, TMG, we declared end of life. So there's no TMG anymore. What about another three-letter acronym? Let's call this one UAG, Unified Access Gateway. This came to Microsoft as an acquisition, actually, so the Whale product. So UAG, though, it's kind of interesting. UAG built on top of TMG. Interesting user interface. There's no video in this room. Interesting user interface. kind of hard to use at times. Very powerful, though, right? I mean, here was the thing. UAG added a whole bunch of really smart, deep application inspection logic into essentially on top of TMG. The downside was that the complexity, we keep coming back, you know, you keep thinking about the word complexity and what does it really gain you. The complexity was that it understood Exchange at a point in time. It understood Exchange 2010 when it was correctly updated and had all the right rules in place, but what happened when we released a service pack? It broke on occasion because we changed the way OAuth worked, or we change some other aspect. And so application inspection is only as good as the point at which you install it and it works. Because the moment you start changing the application, it potentially doesn't work or doesn't protect you properly. There were also scenarios where it just didn't work. So some good examples would be it didn't allow you to do certificate-based auth for ActiveSync. There was one example that UAG didn't allow you to do. Hybrid was another one that didn't work. Trying to get hybrid to work through UAG was a challenge for some, and that's not a scenario that the UAG really could ever was capable of doing. And it was absolutely a bear to configure sometimes. UAG, to get working, was challenging. I know I wrote a couple of white papers, and I promise you I used several four-letter words at numerous points during the creation of those white papers. But we got there in the end, and then we went and released a service pack, and it broke again. So, honestly, that was kind of unfortunate. So, UAG, rest in peace. Another one, we've actually declared that one end of life as well. So why the hell do we do that? I mean, TMG in particular, because TMG for Exchange was a great product. So why the heck did Microsoft go ahead and do that? Well, we kind of went and did it for the long-term strategic reasons of stuff is changing. You know, basic auth against a server and forms-based auth. These are the kind of, and trends like bring your own device and all of these kind of other things that are changing our industry change the way we protect our servers. I may have already mentioned this point maybe 700 times already, right? Stuff changes. Things like federation as well. It's a great example. Federation is, you know, a massive change in how we look at and think about authentication. Those products were trying to do absolutely everything, UAG in particular. UAG was trying to do endpoint inspection on non-Windows device or non-Windows OSs, and it could do all kinds of clever, fancy stuff. But it was trying to do absolutely everything. And as we all know, trying to do absolutely everything means you don't do some things as well as you do other things, right? You know, focus, narrowing down the scenarios is something Microsoft have been trying to do for a number of years, actually. The last few years, we've actually kind of moved into something we would call scenario-focused engineering, trying to think about scenarios rather than just pure features. Let's make sure the scenario you're trying to accomplish is properly engineered and designed, rather than just, let's put another feature in there and then see what users can make of it. Same thing applied, it's common. And so the changing nature of the industry has shifted the security to the application. The applications need to become more secure. It's not just server-based apps like us, but web-based apps or mobile apps or whatever kind of apps they are. The applications need to get better. The applications need to get smarter and more secure. And so, and the key thing is, you know, it's about, I made the comment earlier, it's about trying to make sure people can access the data securely, not just securing the data. People are much more likely to play along with the rules if they're easy and they're simple, but it still happens to be secure, than if you make them jump through a whole bunch of hoops. And the other thing, of course, was getting this code into Windows Server, making the server itself, you know, the firewall, the proxy, whatever term you want to use for it, was really our better long-term strategic goal. So let's look at a few of the other options then. Application request routing. Now, ARR was developed to kind of compete with Apache Squid, really. It's a web server routing and content, you know, delivery engine, right? Put a bunch of servers behind it, put a bunch of web servers behind it, put a bunch of rewriting logic in ARR itself, and use it to publish a bunch of web servers. That's kind of where this thing came from. And it doesn't have any idea what Exchange is. Not a clue, not one. It just sees us as a bunch of HTTP traffic. And there's a few other kind of downsides to ARR. So you can publish Exchange, but there's no pre-auth. You might say, well, why are you saying that's a bad thing? Because you're telling us that pre-auth is a bad thing. Well, I am. I don't think you need pre-auth, which is why ARR is up here as a potential option. Right? ARR is an option, but you need to be aware that it doesn't do pre-authentication. And if you have people that, you know, security people that still insist on the pre-auth piece, then ARR will let you publish Exchange to the internet, but without the pre-auth. And that's not changing. Why is it not changing? There's no ongoing investment in ARR. ARR is a point-in-time piece of work and won't be further developed. There's no PowerShell. There's no monitoring. There's no HA. But it's free, which is good, right? Free's got to be good. The security guy told me that. He said free is good. So here's another option. Web application proxy, or WAP. Just make that disappear. Did you hear that? WAP. Because whenever I think of the name, I just can't think. It's like a cabal. It's like a Batman thing, right? We go, WAP. I should have put a sound effect on that one, too. So web application proxy, built into Windows Server 2012 R2. It's free, therefore, if you're buying Windows Server. Okay? And it's our strategic choice. It's built for today's modern web-based protocols. So I've got here things like ADFS and OAuth, Magic Beans. It knows what Magic Beans are. Anyone else know what Magic Beans are? I bet the security guy does. You should probably ask him when you get back to your office. Ask him what Magic Beans are and watch the look of... He'll probably come up with some bullshit answer. He probably will. Oh, yes, that's the new RSC standard for beam transmission or something. I don't know what it'll be, right? Tokens, you know, all of that kind of federation and ADFS and all of these kind of things. This is what this application really was built to support. And if you've listened to some of the hints that come out of some of the sessions, and I think there's an Outlook session probably tomorrow, I think it might be, not entirely sure, then you'll see that, you know, the change to MAPI HTTP, Mappy HTTP for Outlook connectivity to Exchange 2013, one of the side effects of us doing that is it opens up what people are, you know, carefully calling things like alternative authentication providers. Right? Alternative authentication providers means something other than BASIC or NTLM. So more modern protocols, think about what we're doing and where we're going with a lot of, you know, where this industry is going. You know, these are the kind of technologies that will allow us to bring different types of authentication providers. And this is the kind of application which strategically is going to be built and include that kind of capability. So it requires ADFS. It requires ADFS on Windows Server 2012, and it essentially replaces what we used to call ADFS proxy. It is the strategic choice from Microsoft currently, okay? But it doesn't mean to say that there aren't a couple of caveats, right? The caveats So the current limitation with WAP is that it only does pre-auth for OWA, and it doesn't offer you pre-auth for ActiveSync or Outlook Anywhere connections. No. There we go, right, okay. We got there in the end. But WAP will provide pre-auth for those in a future release. Yay. Excellent. We're learning. That's brilliant. So I realize that short-term now puts us in a slightly tricky position. Because you could say, well, what I've got today, it's a good point for the old analogy story, you know. What I've got today is working great. What I've got today is pretty awesome. It's TMG or UAG or whatever, and everything I've got is pretty good. Should I rip it out and put WAP in instead? Because that's what the Microsoft strategic direction is. Well, the answer would be, well, it depends. If you require still, because you haven't yet managed to strong-arm the security guy into seeing the 21st century, and you still want to do the ActiveSync and Outlook Anywhere pre-auth, then WAP is not currently the solution for you. Doesn't mean you couldn't put WAP in alongside what you've got today and move other applications to it, SharePoint and other applications that are a bit more, you know, web-centric already in their authentication methods, and maybe OWA could go across as well. But what it means is that you wouldn't probably today, if those were still hard requirements, pre-auth, rip out TMG and use this, because you're losing something. But this is the point at which to evaluate. This is the point at which to think about what your needs are going to be in a year from now. And if your needs in a year from now are compatible with this, then you might consider WAP being something you might deploy and grow applications into. And there will be support for those Outlook Anywhere and ActiveSync connections coming in a future update to Windows Server. And so you've got both the shorter term problem and the longer term problem. WAP is the longer term answer. The shorter term problem would be to keep what you've got today. Now, I used to tell this story that, you know, I had a 2000 Expedition when I moved to the US. I bought a ridiculously sized vehicle because I moved to America. And because you do, right? And that car was just great. And it actually did exactly what I wanted to do. It didn't have a whole bunch of cool stuff that cars do today, but it really worked great, and I was very happy with it. I used to tell that story because a year ago, I totally got rid of it and bought something with all the bells and whistles. But I did it when I really wanted to do it, as opposed to just because they stopped making my Ford Expedition didn't mean I had to take it and sell it, you know? There's the thing. It was working great. It was meeting all my needs. Why did I feel the need to get rid of it? I didn't. I got rid of it because I decided I had different needs and requirements. I bought a pickup truck. Hey. Huge one as well. It's massive. Anyway, so if you want to know more about WAP and ARR, you could ask these two handsome gentlemen tomorrow. So both Georg and Roop are both sitting right here in this room. And Roop apparently was welded to a desk at this stage, but this is not him. And Georg is actually black and white in real life, actually, if you see him. So Georg and Roop are doing a session tomorrow morning, 8:30 a.m. Favorite slot of every presenter, the 8:30 a.m. slot. So it goes with the last session on the last day of the conference slot, which is another popular choice. And so that would be a great session where the guys are going to go through WAP and ARR, give you a whole bunch of detailed information about those, how to configure them, how to do a bunch of different stuff, a whole different bunch of scenarios with them. And one hopes that if you go to that session, I'm sure you will pick up a lot of good information and ask them questions about those specific products. So what about some of the other little pieces that we've got? So the load balancers that do pre-auth. I know there are some of them. Some of the vendors of those may well be here in the audience. They added pre-auth modules in some ways to compensate for the fact that we got rid of TMG, or we decided to end of life TMG. TMG has not stopped working, by the way, just because we decided it didn't actually go bang the following morning and stop working. It actually still works pretty darn well for most customers that have it, okay? So the load balancers, but they're doing, this is kind of quite old school still in terms of what we're talking about, basic auth. Maybe NTLM auth as well. But they're doing a great job at load balancing, no doubt at all, right? Great job at load balancing. But taking that option, if you've already got TMG, moving to a load balancer that essentially is doing the same thing strikes me as kind of just changing one thing for another, really. Nothing's really changing. I would urge you to think more about what the longer-term strategic goal is, right? What the long-term plan is for this, and whether you still really need pre-auth rather than doing this. So, yes, just like my mother, they're essentially, you know, one could argue, a little bit thinking about how we used to be, because they're filling a gap, and I totally respect that. That's good. But what else could you do? Well, you could use the load balancer just on its own. Go back to the no pre-auth thing again, right? The load balancer, and here's an interesting one as well. So a packet filtering firewall, the firewall that the security guy loves to tell you. He sets up a bunch of rules, and he's like, source IP address pool or destination protocol, whatever it may be. Destination is this IP address on this protocol and this port. Complex rules. I remember seeing firewalls, all these complex rules set up, and setting some up myself the same. It's kind of what your load balancer is actually already doing. The load balancer already has a listener. The load balancer already will ignore packets that arrive at it and don't comply to the rules that you configured in the load balancer. And it will then forward the traffic to the host that you configured behind it. So the load balancer just doing that is the same as what would be a packet filtering firewall. It's the same. There's no difference really between the two, I would argue. And so why don't you just let it do what it's good at, which is enforcing network-based rules, source IP and destination IP, protocols and ports. Let it do that piece. And then pass off the responsibility for the authentication, authorization, and the security, the data and everything else. Leave that to the operating system, which you're keeping up to date, and Exchange, which you're keeping up to date, and both of which you are managing and monitoring properly. And if you do that, you'll find you've simplified your environment dramatically. You're certainly more in an environment like we run, where we just have load balancers, essentially, sitting on the edge of the internet. So that would be the direction that I would urge you to take. So what should you do? Obviously, the first thing to do is panic furiously and wildly. That would be a great idea. But then, I'm repeating myself because I sincerely believe this is the point at which people, you know, you've got to think. What we've been doing, and it was a realization for me, and it was a realization for me as somebody who wrote the guidance white papers on using TMG and UAG to publish Exchange. So I've invested more than a few hours in telling people how to make this stuff work with Exchange. And I had an interesting discussion with one of the Exchange GPMs. It was probably 18 months or 2 years ago, and he said, why do you bother with all that stuff? Which led to a discussion, which kind of led me to change the way I kind of feel about it, genuinely, right? It genuinely feels that we've been doing something, and I remember watching sessions at a tech ed with ISA server and Exchange 10 years ago, and it feels like if you're doing the same, we're doing the same things over and over again. And I'm not sure that doing things over and over again, you know, is necessarily the right thing to do 10 years after the fact. So I kind of changed my thinking. So this is a great opportunity to really think about how security really is done, how you evaluate it, and what you're going to do to protect yourself. So just because TMG and UAG are EOL does not mean you are SOL. Hopefully that acronym might mean something to you, because I'm not going to do it because there's a recording going on probably. Sad. Anyway, okay. So, you know, there's the thing. It's about evaluating the risks, really, the risks that are today. You know, go back to that point I made about hybrid, right? Going into hybrid, and I'm sure some of you have had this conversation, we need to exclude some paths from pre-auth on TMG in order for us to do hybrid. You do. Sad fact, right, at the moment. It's true. But it doesn't change the dynamics of most of the risks. Most of the risks are still the same risks, you know? And so just treating the, you know, think about what's a new risk rather than what's an existing risk, because the existing risks are what you already guard against. So I am finishing up. So here's what your call to action really is, okay? If you think you're as good as you are, and I would hope you are good, otherwise you wouldn't probably be at a conference like this, right? You know Exchange well. You know how to run Exchange. You know how to run Exchange securely. We are secure out of the box. You know, the question of how do I harden Exchange comes up on occasion inside Microsoft, or I get asked that question. You don't have to. You really don't. And I would strongly discourage people from fiddling around in IIS, because I know some of them do, trying to remove things that they don't think we need. Very helpful of them to do that, you know, because all those extra bits, they clutter up the server, obviously, right? But Exchange is secure out of the box. We run it in its default configuration at Microsoft and in Exchange Online. We don't apply security hardening templates. We run a secure operating system and a secure application, and we watch the heck out of it, okay? And really, there's the thing. So if they're the answers, I would suggest you try and keep it simple as much as you can. Watch what's going on. If you want to put a pre-auth in front of it and say that you don't need to worry, well, you probably still do anyway. So on that note, I'm gonna wrap up. I'm going to keep it short and sweet today. And I'm going to ask that you fill out evals. Don't forget to do your evals. And they are, despite what any of the speakers tell you, they're hugely important. They really are. They're really helpful. So, and I'd appreciate any feedback afterwards. I'm happy to take any questions. If there's anybody has any questions. If not, questions, sir. Do you want to take the microphone?
So I work at a company that is not going to listen to the concept of no pre-auth.
Why is that?
That's because we're in the law field, and our all of our colleagues get sued when they lose client data, or when the clients even think they're at risk.
Okay.
So they've decided that RSA is indispensable. We just did a big upgrade. So we have forever, or since maybe 2000, we've had RSA as a two-factor for OWA, among other things. So TMG, obviously, end of life. I know I can still make it work. It works for 2010 just fine.
Sure. Works for 2013 just fine as well.
And that, my question is, what is WAP in this spectrum? Does it have any kind of, and with TMG, you had a built-in agent.
Right. Okay. So let's answer the second question first, and then we'll come back and pick you about. Because we're in law, that means we have to have two-factor auth, right? Obviously. we have lawyers too at Microsoft. We don't have two-factor auth in front of us, but anyway, I'm just saying. So the second question, so WAP. WAP is using ADFS as its authentication source, and ADFS can be used to provide multiple forms of auth against it. So you authenticate against ADFS. Now, if ADFS is requiring you to have different types of authentication, then that's what you provide to ADFS. ADFS is then giving you back a token, and you're coming back and giving that token. And so it's ADFS is actually doing the authentication provision at that stage. So the answer to the question would be whatever auth ADFS can do is now what you can do and still publish Exchange. That make sense? We're essentially outsourcing the authentication to somebody else, which is also what OAuth is something that gives us the capability to do. Okay, so OAuth is another approach where authentication is against another provider, ADFS again, and then Exchange is just consuming the token and granting you access to the resources. Okay, so that's a common story. Go back to the first thing, which is we're in law, and we could be sued even if people think we might lose their data. Terrifying world, isn't it, really? Okay. Well, okay. So how do we address that? Let's have a think about this for a second, right? So there are some industries, I agree, will find it very hard to go against this. Have you ever had has there ever been a security breach come through the internet? Has there ever been a security breach and loss of data from inside the network that you would admit to? Probably not, because the lawyers will have you, right? So probably don't. But let's assume that there probably has been at some point. The two-factor auth solution you can accomplish through a variety of different ways. So if a security organization want to have stronger multiple forms of auth, the secure ID token is absolutely one way of doing it. Do they do any form of machine authentication as well, or is it just you have a token? So here's an interesting one, right? So what it is if you have a secure ID token, could you download stuff to a personal computer? Does that bother them? So if a home computer, can you connect to your email on your home computer and just provide some kind of two-factor auth thing? You can do that? They don't see that as a problem?
There's a lot of changes happening.
Okay. Don't worry. So here's the thing. There's a bunch of different scenarios and problems that we could face. And so typically what you see is kind of interesting that a two-factor auth solution that still allows you essentially to log in from any computer anywhere and access the data has obvious flaws, okay? And so whether the company does or doesn't, they could also look at doing additional forms of authentication, which might be machine-based auth. So IPsec is a great example of another type of solution which can authenticate the machine, and then you can authenticate the user. And you can still do two-factor auth with IPsec and a username and a password or a certificate, right? You still get the same form of auth. But in addition, you actually secure the machine, or you protect, you know the endpoint that's coming in. So I tried to make the point earlier as well. I'm not trying to say everyone throw away pre-auth. There's an understanding there, a discussion to be had, which is we're protecting against this one problem with our two-factor auth solution. What else are we missing? And there's probably a bunch of other stuff that we're missing. And a more holistic approach to thinking about the security may actually plug that hole and a bunch of others and give them actually more secure access. I don't know. I could just be talking out of my behind, but we can carry on afterwards. You have a question? Go for it.
Company, we're using we treat all users as external users.
Okay.
We're using TMG to publish all 7 exchange protocols.
Okay.
Main reason we're using TMG is because our business requirements, we provide single name entry for all users. So all users just typing one name and they're getting any protocol that they're
sure.
using.
Okay.
So in this scenario, what would you recommend to replace TMG with?
I wouldn't replace TMG if it's working for you currently, right now. That would be my first response.
This is end of okay. life, and our upper management concern about contract. What if it's...
They
banks?
Are.
Where can go for support?
Okay, it's end of life and upper management are concerned, but it's still working okay, yeah?
It's working perfect.
There we go, terrific. All right. So it's working just lovely. So my first thing would be just leave it as it alone, but I agree. The tactical thing is, in the short term, leave it where it is. In the long term, WAP would be the direction that I would suggest you look at. IMAP and POP. So do you do pre-auth on IMAP and POP?
No, we don't.
Can't do it. No.
We don't do,
all right. So
one name for all protocols.
Okay. Then another approach you could I would go down the route of do you really need to do the pre-auth? I really would.
It's not a requirement.
It's not a pre-auth requirement. Then you get a lovely load balancer. You put it in front, you publish all the 7 protocols, and you put a pool of exchange servers behind it, and call it done. The load balancer, it's the future. You should get one. All right, I'm sure you do. Okay, but definitely I would do that. If pre-auth is not a requirement, you have a perfectly good load balancer right now, yeah? Terrific device, use it for that. All right, so I hope this has been entertaining, maybe a little informative as well. And don't forget to fill out your evals, and thank you very much.